Talks with Aaron, Polly, and Andrew. I'm Aaron.
This is Paul.
And I am Andrew, not Wayne, Andrew.
Well, you know, we can tell. But guys, you know how we can tell? It's a sports ball time. You know, there are sports ball matches all across this great hemisphere. It's crazy. There is the football, which according to some is life, happening all over the place. Right here in my very own hometown, we have got we've got sports ball matches happening over in the AT&T Stadium. It's crazy. There are foreigners from all over the place eating Texas barbecue. They are you know,
they're posting about it.
They are killing commute times across the area. I mean, let me tell you, my office is, I mean, walking distance from the AT&T Stadium, and it is crazy what the traffic has done. But I got to say, you know, everyone's leaning into it. People who have never, you know, watched a soccer game in their life are all into the soccer. At work, we've said, you know, you can wear your World Cup team, FIFA, whatever you call it, jerseys, you know, whatever, you know, between now and mid-July when the tournament ends. And so I was like, hey, you know what? I am not a soccer guy, but I am a Ted Lasso guy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, I'm gonna get me a Roy Kent jersey.
An AFC Richmond Roy Kent jersey.
An AFC Richmond Roy Kent jersey. Why? Because he's here. He's there. He's fucking everywhere. Anyway, so I went online. $75 for that thing.
That's not a bad price.
He's a good player. Yeah. You know, when they're popular like that.
I mean, if you're getting an actual national jersey, I haven't looked, but they're usually around like $100, $120.
Yeah, an actual jersey from an actual real player is probably like $120.
Well, I would expect that, but I mean, come on. It's from the Warner Brothers store.
I mean, some people, but some people are like you. Some people, Ted Lasso may have more fans in the U.S. than, say, the U.S. MLS. National team. Yeah. Well, yeah, MLS for sure. But no, it's been great. My wife has been in Boston for part of last week for visiting family, and she has said
she enjoying all the
army.
Kilts out there. She enjoying.
She's leaving you for a Scotman.
I told her not to. We'll see if she listens. I remind her that I'm already of Scottish descent, but she said there's lots of Scotsmen having a lot of fun.
She's like, then why don't you look like this? Where's your beard and your kilts? Yes.
I mean, I've seen the video. I would definitely buy a kilt. If that's what it took to keep my wife, I would get a kilt. I would wear a kilt. I would do that. But, yeah, no, it's been amazing. I mean, the U.S. has had two good games, two strong games against Paraguay and Australia.
They're in the round of 32. They have made, as of this recording, they have made it to the round of 32.
Yes, with one game left to play in the group stage.
Yeah, so they're going to totally phone that third game in.
I would.
As you do. Yeah. As you do.
As you do. Yeah. You know, this is a good sports ball weekend, Aaron. You know, I mean, he doesn't care, but, you know, we've got the FIFA World Cup. We've got the Royal Ascot, if you're into to horse racing, and we've got the U.S. Open being played. So, you know, it is nonstop sports on the television here at the Apollon household.
Well, and not just sports. Okay.
Oh, I was just going to say, I besmirch the sports ball frequently, but, you know, a lot of that's a shtick on my part. It's not that I despise the sports ball. It's that I don't need another hobby. I don't need something else occupying my time. You know, it's the same reason I never got into Magic the Gathering. I'm just like, the last thing I need is something else that, you know, takes up my time, takes up my money. I just don't need it. So
The only I'm much the same way. I remember telling Jen once, I'm like, I am borderline, like I'm fighting the obsession on being a shoe guy.
I think you are actually a shoe guy. When you make
That was the conversation we had before I became the shoe, before I turned into this guy who has 40 pairs of shoes. Yeah, I was like, I'm resisting. And then Mark Wahlberg, you know, started his shoe company. I'm like, all right, now I'm a shoe guy. So now I've got like a lot of shoes. But I tell you, the thing that I'm fighting right now is baseball cards, and I'm not even a baseball.
Oh, really?
Like,
what are you doing, Paul?
This trading card thing is like all over my timeline. Not Pokemon. I'm not going to be like one of those people getting into fist fights over Pokemon cards at Target. But I don't know, like, because I'm watching sports, and you know, it's, if you watch sports, you get, you know, like all this sporting card stuff pushed at you, and it's not just baseball cards, right? There's like Formula One, there's, you know, World Cup stuff, and it's like, and like people buy these cards and go crazy for them, and they're worth money and stuff, and I'm like, but am I that person? I don't need another hobby.
No, fight that off.
I don't need another hobby. Yeah, I'm gonna keep fight fighting that one.
Fight that one.
As
someone who. Yeah, just remember cardboard crack days, and just remember you don't go that
crack.
Don't go that direction. Don't go down that road.
You know, the World Cup, you know, like, I'm not a Lego person, but I bought a Lionel Messi Lego a few weeks back, and it was like, I don't know, 500. It's like a little Lionel Messi with his number behind him, like, you know, kicking the ball. I was like, I'm gonna buy this. Like, it's, you know, I'm all into the World Cup. This will be fun. I could put it on a shelf, and I put it together. And I'm like, wow, this is actually enjoyable. So I bought three more. So I got Cristiano Ronaldo, and I got the actual World Cup, and I got a Lewis Hamilton F1 helmet. That's the next one I have to put together.
See, I can get all behind a Lego obsession because I've loved Lego forever. And I just for my birthday, I got a baby Grogu Lego that stands about, I don't know, a foot and a half, 2 feet tall. So I can definitely encourage, support that road to go down for you, Paul.
Yeah. I don't need
it's a sickness.
Hobby. Well, I will tell you, the thing about the Lego is that, like, it's kind of like a stress reliever.
Yeah. You do it while you're watching TV. Yeah.
Yeah. When Murphy is losing his mind and I've said for the thousandth time in one day, don't hump your sister. Sometimes I just want to sit down and focus on a Lego for a few minutes. You know,
I mean, that is the conversation parents are having every day with their sons.
Some states they are
humping your sister.
I really should have named them Luke and Leia.
So, Aaron, you know what else is going on in your backyard this weekend?
Oh gosh, no telling.
Rush is playing Fort Worth tomorrow.
Oh really? I had not heard that. Where are they playing? Do you know?
It's somewhere in Fort Worth. I do. Let me see. I could probably tell the exact.
Dickies Arena.
But one of my colleagues is going to be. It is the Dickies Arena of June 24th, 7:30. And the tickets are cheaper than World Cup tickets. So you got that going. One of my colleagues flew down for the weekend to specifically to see Rush.
I do love me some Geddy Lee.
And I said, you know, there's a World Cup going on in Dallas right now, too. And he was like,
and what? I mean, and it's killing. I mean, it's not just it's happening in Arlington, right in the mid-city. So, right, you know, equidistant between Dallas and Fort Worth. And it is clogging all the traffic because there are events occurring everywhere.
Yeah, like Fan Fest and.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it is just nuts. The traffic I drove into Arlington yesterday morning at 8 a.m. And, you know, it was a federal holiday. Traffic was crazy. I mean, just crazy. I was 8 o'clock in the morning and the traffic was crazy. Not for people going to work, but for, you know, people going to different, you know, World Cup stuff. It was just nuts.
Well,
just nuts.
It's there are games in Kansas City, which is about 2 hours away from me. Not too far, although they've been doing construction on I-70 for like a year. But anyway, I keep looking at the tickets. They're expensive enough that I feel slightly irresponsible if I were to splurge and buy tickets.
Yep.
To attend. They're holding an Arrowhead, which, you know, huge football stadium like most of these are being held in. But I just. It's bad because in 94, I actually did go see a World Cup game. Last time it was in the U.S. I saw Germany play Bolivia in Chicago at Soldier Field. And it was a great experience. And I'd like to go back this year, but I just can't quite. Currently paying for a college for a child to go to college. I just
off
like.
Off campus, yeah.
Yeah, out of state.
Yeah.
And so it's like I just don't have the fun money that I do when I'm not paying college tuition for someone.
Yep.
You know, a year ago. Or, you know, at least for the last 2 years, I've been like, we're going to go see a World Cup game. Like, we are absolutely going to go see a World Cup game. I put, like, a little deposit down on World Cup tickets. You could do that early. And, you know, but that was literally a year ago before, or maybe 2 years ago, because it was before we knew Michigan was going to be a thing. Like before Michigan was even a glint in our eye, before we moved here. And I'm like, oh, we'll go up to Jersey or go to Philly, you know, wherever they're, you know, we'll see a game somewhere on the East Coast, because it was only like 5-6 hour drive. It's only like a 5 hour drive to Jersey from Tidewater, Virginia. And so we moved, and I'm like, well, guess that's dead to us now, because now we're and there, you know, because like there's, you know, like in my mind, there's nothing close to Detroit. Like, it's not like they're playing in Chicago or anything like that. And then we got the dogs. So, you know, of course, now we've got 14-week-old puppies. It's not like we can go, you know, out of town.
Run off
to Kansas City. Like, I thought maybe we'll go to Kansas City, see a game in Arrowhead. Like, but, you know, now we've made decisions to negate the possibility of doing that. And it didn't even occur to me that Toronto is only 4 hours away from here.
Really, 3.5. Yeah.
Like, had I known... Had I had a better sense of geography up here, decisions might have been made differently.
This is the cost of not effectively teaching geography in public
school. Yes. This is the cost of being an English major, people. Yeah, geography, not my thing. Ask me what states border Michigan. I don't know. Ohio's one of them. And I guess Illinois. But just yeah,
sad state of affairs.
Yeah. It is. You know, our American education system. It is what it is. But you know, Aaron. Well, and Andrew revealed right before this podcast. You know, Aaron and I have been espousing the wonder that is Widow's Bay on Apple TV. You know, they just wrapped up their first season. I did not realize there was going to be a second season.
There wasn't supposed to be.
Yeah, but I mean, clearly they're set up for more. And so there will be a second season of Widow's Bay, but the first season wrapped up. You know, everyone has been asking Stephen King what they think of Widow's Bay. He's like, it's good, but Maximum Pleasure Guaranteed is better. So now I have to check that show out, too.
Where is that playing?
It is also also Apple. It's got Tatiana Maslany, and apparently it's very Hitchcockian.
Okay.
So I'm very curious about that. That'll be probably the next one I hop into.
I've not heard of that one at all.
I gotta say, I enjoyed Widow's Bay from the jump, and it got better as it went along, and it started off good. I will say that I think Widow's Bay is probably the best show on television this year. I loved it upside and down. I think, hands down,
Widow's Bay not only started strong, it got stronger throughout the 10-episode season. Rarely had a misstep. I mean, there were some episodes. I would say there's not even any real throwaway episodes. You know, it was all establishing this, you know, the context and the background of this island. And I mean, it is just, yeah, I would say it's probably the best first season of any show I've seen in quite a while.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, not just to say that, you know, it was the most entertaining show, but every episode drove the story forward. There wasn't a Monster of the Week episode, right? I mean, it's all driving the story forward. Every single episode is character driven. It is really, you know, because there's such a sense of whimsy and comedy in this horror show. I think that it is really easy for a lot of stories like that to just look at the joke density and create comedy irrespective of character, right? You know, jokes that don't make sense when you look at it from the character standpoint. But all the humor in this series derives from character. And I find that so refreshing, because I get so frustrated with stories that just write for the joke as opposed to writing for the character in the story. I absolutely loved this. And I do not remember the actor's name, but the woman who plays Patricia.
Yes.
She has got to be my favorite character on the show. She is, number one, I feel like there is a deliberate attempt to make her resemble Shelley Duvall. You know, because there are scenes where you're like, oh my gosh, you know, she could like be Shelley Duvall's, you know, daughter or sister. I mean, she's just there's such a striking resemblance, particularly in that, you know, haunted sort of mania that she had in The Shining. But the episode, and spoilers, Andrew, the episode that focuses on her and the boogeyman.
Yes.
She is just magnificent.
So the actress's name is Kate O'Flynn, and she's British. Who knew?
Yeah. Yeah. She is just amazing. I love her. She is certainly an odd sort of bird, but, you know, she does the things that I think, you know, a lot of us who watch horror movies go, well, why didn't they do that? Why didn't they do that? And I mean, once she realizes that the strangler, you know, the boogeyman, you know, can't be knocked down, you know, can't be killed, she just never takes the gun off of him. I mean, he's quote dead on a gurney in the ambulance. She's sitting over him with a gun. They're pushing him into the incinerator. She's standing over him with a gun. They open up the incinerator with the ashes. She's standing over him with a gun. You know, I think she is just awesome. I love that
character. She is. Yeah, I do too. I mean, honestly, this show, you know, it's funny because I had it on TV, I don't know, the other day or something, and Jen walks in the room. She's like, oh, I love that guy. I'm like, who? She's like, Matthew Reese. I'm like, how do you know this guy's name? Like, Matt Reese. I'm like, I have no idea. I had no idea who he was, but apparently he was in The Americans. He's married to Kerry Russell, so she is a fan of his. So she was rather upset that I was watching a show with him without her, but I was like, I had no idea who this guy was because I've never seen any of those shows.
Yeah, Matt Reese, he was in The Americans with Kerry Russell, as you mentioned, his wife. He was also in Perry Mason on HBO Max, which he played Perry Mason on HBO Max. He was fantastic in that. I love him. And he was in recently, and I want to say it's an Apple show with Claire Danes, and he plays a guy who is her next door neighbor who is suspected of murder. And
interesting.
He's super creepy in that.
No, you're right. Beast in Me.
Yeah, okay. The Beast in Me. Yeah. Terrific actor. I don't think I've ever seen him in something that I didn't love him.
It's funny. I don't think I've ever seen him in something.
He's a Welshman.
I'm looking at his, you know, his filmography. I mean, mm-hmm. I may have heard his voice because he's done some voice work for shows like Archer. Mm-hmm. And stuff like that, but I don't think I've ever seen anything with him in it. That's funny.
If you've never watched The Americans, Paul, that's something I think you would really dig. It is.
He was in Cocaine Bear. Oh, he was. Oh, no. Okay, never mind. I was like, oh, he was the voice of Night Owl in the Watchmen animated movie, which I didn't see. Yeah, no, I mean, I've never seen anything with this guy.
It's like you've actively been avoiding Matt Reeves.
It kind of feels like it. I mean, he's done some things that are genuinely, you know, well-known. I've just not seen them.
or maybe Matt Reeves is trying to actively avoid Paul, perhaps.
That could be
it. Might be.
That
could Seems be very it. Likely.
Well, you know, you guys were talking last week about, you know, talking about Widow's Bay this week. Now that all the episodes are available. And I made the goal. I was like, well, I will just binge through all 10 episodes by Saturday. And I failed. But I did get through the first four of 10. And I got to say, I was not expecting to be quite as comedic. But in that first episode, as soon as Steven Root popped his head up, I was sucked. I love Steven Root. I'm a huge Steven Root fan. And he plays his role phenomenally as
the haunted, basically crazy. The Quint, right? He's the Quint of the series, you know, and Matt Reeves is kind of like the mayor of the, so, you know, there's lots of Correct. Jaws.
There's very much, and that's what I was going to say. There are so many strong Jaws vibe where you have the local guy warning everybody about the horrific thing. And then, you know, the establishment who, you know, mayor who wants to make sure the tourist season isn't ruined is trying to squelch it and quash it and to keep everything open.
The sheriff in it, you know, who's kind of like his own thing, you know, it's, you know, the show is just, every character is so well written and so well acted, you know, and you know, you're only four episodes in, Andrew, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I'm almost jealous because you get to, you know, to I you know, the mythology of this show continues to unfold over time. And it is, you know, by the fourth episode, you know, the fourth, one of the things I love about the show is it's 10 episodes and they don't keep you waiting till the eighth episode. Shit really starts hitting the fan in the third episode.
Yeah.
Right. And maybe because what was the second episode, the one with the clown, or was it the third episode?
Second. And I was going to say, out of the first four, I think the second has been my favorite so far, when he has to spend the night locked in the inn and sleep in the captain's suite. And that innkeeper cracks me up. He won't roll the suitcase in to the captain's suite because he doesn't want to step inside. It's like he just kind of throws it.
Well, and I love how that whole thing comes up where he's essentially dared to go sleep. Okay, well, go sleep in the inn. But you have to do all of these things. Oh yeah, make him go into the attic all the way to the back of the attic.
Oh yeah, the crawlspace. Yeah, that was horrific.
Yeah.
And then William, like the selection of games on their game shelf, it starts out with like normal games like Ticket to Ride, chess, and you get down to things like Teeth, which just has a pair of pliers inside of it.
You know,
one of my favorite scenes is when they're doing the tour at the museum, and you know they're talking about the history of the island, and the witches. We caught them. We burned them. You know, took immediate, you know, civic pride. We did the right thing there.
Well, in that episode where, you know, he turns on the TV in the room and it's like, welcome to Widow's Bay. Follow me and I'll show you around. It's like 5 minutes of the guy just walking out of the camera down the beach. And then when he comes back, it's just an empty beach.
Like, real Twin Peaks sort of vibe to it.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Oh, yeah. That's such a good... out of the first four, like I said, I think that's my favorite so far. But episode three was the Sea Hag episode.
Episode three was the Sea Hag. And I'd say that, you know, even though the second episode has the clown, like, it still kind of ends with, like, everything's back to status quo. But episode three with the Sea Hag, and then episode four for sure with the party, that's where it just kind of takes off from there. Like, there's no... it just keeps going. There's a flashback episode, and I'm not spoiling too much, but there is a flashback episode to the origins of the town and some of the characters that they reference that I think is so well done.
Same. And what I thought was interesting, the week that the flashback episode came back, you know, it takes you back to the 1700s.
Yeah, early 1700s.
And they released two episodes that week. And, you know, I always get worried when I see that. Oh, man, that means this episode's going to suck. That episode was so good. I was hungry for the next episode. And so I loved having those two episodes that week. But I thought they were both strong.
Yeah. And I think they tie together.
Yes.
You know, like the episode six and seven. So you're on episode four right now, Andrew. Like episode six and seven basically should be watched together because you know there's the episode six sets up something that's pretty significant in episode seven. Strong Jaws vibes again as we get to episode seven, and then you know 8, 9, and 10 were not released together, but very much could be enjoyed together as well. Even though eight is the Boogeyman episode, so it's 9 and 10 that. You can watch together, but it's just so good. And I, you know, even if it was just a one and done, well, if it was a one and done, I feel like I would have been disappointed by the end. I think it stuck the landing as the end of a first season. I don't know that it would have stuck the landing if that was it, but I think they knew early enough that the storyline would continue because there's still so much to understand of so much to, to explore of what's coming.
This is kind of like the ending of season one of Andor, which was good, but really just kind of paved the way for season two of Andor.
I think I'd say yes in some ways, yes in some ways, no. I think there is definitely a conclusion to certain aspects in season one that you will leave it feeling satisfied, but there is so much world building that happens that and things that are teased that you want to know more.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You want to see, you know, there are things that happen. I don't want to spoil it, but there are things that happen in the 10th episode that beg to be explored further.
Further, yeah.
And so, it's what's interesting about this show, you know, it's done so well. And you know, the critical response has been so huge. Is apparently, you know, the creator of the show, or one of the creators of the show, is a screenwriter who. This started, I think, 20 years ago as a spec script for Parks and Recreation.
Mm-hmm. Really?
And, you know, they basically scrapped it and, you know, repivoted Parks and Recreation to the show it ended up being. You know, the screenwriter, her name is Kate Diepold. And, you know, she kind of held on to that script for 20 years and brought it back out to, because it's a project she's always wanted to revisit. But history of comedy, she wrote the movie The Heat with Melissa McCarthy. She was involved in the Ghostbusters, you know, the Melissa McCarthy Ghostbusters movie, Disney's Haunted Mansion movie, stuff like that. But yeah, you know, history in Mad TV and Parks and Rec. So, you know, that's where the humor comes from. And I think the thing about it is I don't love humor like Parks and Rec and those types of things. But like in Widow's Bay, I think the humor really works.
Yeah. It's that office place, you know, that workspace sort of comedy that I think works so well because, you know, it is very – a lot of what we're seeing in the show is the, you know, bureaucracy of how you run a city, right?
Yeah.
Even in a small town. And so I think that it is really well placed, the comedy, because of her experience writing on Parks and Rec.
Yeah. I can't recommend the show enough, really. You don't need to listen to me because everyone online is saying the same thing.
That's
which
right.
I'm almost glad. It's one of those shows. It's kind of like Ted Lasso. Like, I picked it up just because I was interested in it. And, you know, by the time the first season wrapped up, now the world knows about it. And, you know, I feel happy about, like, being involved in something from the ground floor like that. Because usually I just discover something after the first season has ended and everyone starts talking about it. That's my usual MO. So, you know, hopping on this one early and it was just one of those shows that the trailer, even the initial trailer was so well done. That I was like, that show looks really good. I got to check it out. And Apple is doing prestige television right now.
They're making the best TV on TV right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, Star City, if you guys haven't caught on to that yet, oh my God, it's good.
I'm not. I want to check out that Maximum Pleasure Guaranteed show, and I want to check out the new Cape Fear. I've heard good things about that.
I'm not interested in the new Cape Fear.
Yeah, I'm not.
I've heard positive things.
I have not been interested in Cape Fear in any of its iterations. That is just not something for me.
You know, I remember when the De Niro movie came out, and I, you know, in the early 90s, and I liked it, but like I it's not something that I felt needed to be revisited, but you know, with the cast as it is and the positive reviews, I might check it out.
Yeah. My favorite Cape Fear product was the Simpsons parody with Sideshow Bob.
Yes.
I don't know, was that like season 3? Yeah. Where they relocated to like Lake Terror, or no, it was Cape Terror, something like that. But yeah, I'm not a huge Cape Fear fan either.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so Widow's Bay, highest possible recommendation. Check it out. But, you know, on this episode, the comics we're going to talk about this episode, we decided to do a little bit of a special episode today.
A theme week.
A themed week.
On a very special episode of Funny Books with Aaron and Polly.
You know,
it's the Funny Books with Aaron and Polly after school episode.
It is. A lesson will be learned at the end of this episode. You know, I learned some lessons for sure. So lots of like pulp hero books, you know, classic pulp heroes with new iterations have come out over the recent few weeks. And so we decided to hop into them and, you know, starting with Tarzan Beyond, which is from a new publisher, even though I think they're like a subset of an existing publisher, Alien Books. Mm-hmm. But I actually think they may be like a subsidiary of maybe Dynamite or IDW or something.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they published Tarzan Beyond. Yes, they're a subset of IDW. And so, you know, we've got this new Tarzan Beyond book. It's written by Steve Orlando, art by Renato Guedes. And I was quite excited for this book. You know, I love the character of Tarzan. You know, I try to check out almost every iteration in comics, but much like some of these other pulp heroes, I find Tarzan one of those characters that's hard to get right.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron, I'm curious what your thoughts were about Tarzan Beyond.
So there's a lot. First, let me start this way. Paul, how did you read this book? I assume you read it digitally.
digitally, and the guided view is not a thing on this book.
Yeah, which is true of all the books we're going to talk about today. That none of these books employ the guided view. It's essentially you're reading a PDF, which I found super frustrating. Because I really do enjoy me some guided view.
And I don't know why that happens. I don't know if it's...
I think it's... part of me feels like it is how these smaller companies upload their data. And maybe because they don't get enough purchases, Comixology doesn't spend the time, you know, deploying guided view. Or maybe it's an additional service they have to pay for. I don't know. But boy, it really made the reading of it challenging, in my opinion. That said, let me tell you, the artwork, and I'm not sure if it's Renato Guedes or Renato Geddes, but the artwork Geddes, is great in this book. The artwork is just great. I really enjoyed the artwork. And the thing that's interesting about this book is that this is not a Tarzan book set in the early 1900s, right? This is a Tarzan book set in modern day. You know, so the Tarzan Beyond is Tarzan right now. And so you would think that it would be, okay, so he's recently shipwrecked on this island. Nope. This is Tarzan who has access to a Lazarus pit.
Like you said, Lazarus Pit Tarzan.
Yeah, that and I gotta
ridiculous.
Tell you,
ridiculous.
It does, doesn't it? And it sounds great. I was like, okay, I'm here for this. I'm kind of this is cool. However, they throw a bunch of stuff at you in the first issue, which you know a first issue should do, but. So much of it it's like a shotgun technique. We're going to put a lot out there and just see what lands. And for me, the Lazarus Pit, my term, not theirs, part of it I thought was a great idea. You know, that there is this magical fountain on the island that, you know, if used appropriately, will, you know, restore health, extend life, yada, yada. What I don't care for, though, I like my Tarzan with limited English, right? I like my Tarzan primitive. I like my Tarzan the man who is more noble than, quote, civilized man, but, you know, is by, you know, external and modern society's view primitive. That's the Tarzan that I like, right?
You like the noble savage.
I do. But Tarzan here is like special operative Tarzan, you know.
Which begs the question as to why he still wears a loincloth, right? Like, in my mind, this is smart, intelligent, you know, well-educated, noble Tarzan, you know.
Maybe he's onto something.
He's still in his loincloth.
Maybe he knows something we don't know. Maybe we should try a loincloth.
Maybe.
I mean, I have. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm wearing a loincloth right now.
Right
now. I think part of it's cool, but part of it they modernized Tarzan so much that, you know, he's just another guy. You know, for all intents and purposes, he could be Jason Statham. I found that frustrating. There was not nearly enough of him being Tarzan, you know, being cool, you know, doing stuff with monkeys and gorillas and stuff with leopards and lions. And, you know, there just wasn't enough of that. I mean, yeah, certainly you get some of it, but it was so much of them scattershotting the story and all the many characters. I mean, how many supporting characters did we meet, Paul?
Oh, I know. And, you know, the first page is like so, so much text to explain. And, you know, like to the point that I was like, is there a prior miniseries?
Right. I feel like we were picking it up, you know.
Yeah. Like you said, the establishment of this Lazarus Pit Tarzan thing feels like something that, like, we're continuing from a prior story. And maybe we are, but it didn't say, you know, check out. And this is, to my knowledge, this is a brand new comic company or, you know, imprint. So, like, I think this is genuinely the first issue of a new continuity. But, like, I mean, the first page is nothing but text explaining the Manjani, the Kaji, the Kavaru, the Oparians, the Valmak, the Lazarus Pit thing, you know, like.
Yeah, it's a huge exposition dump.
Keep in mind, it's not just Tarzan. It's also Jane. You know, that bathe in the waters of this, I think it's the Fountain of Youth, not necessarily the Lazarus Pit, but, you know, so they both have stayed young, which I find a little, like, selfish. Like, we're going to keep ourselves alive, but, like, everyone else can grow old.
Yeah. Well, if they understand the dangers of overpopulation and the disparity that would be created if they revealed the existence of this fountain, you've obviously they understand that, Paul.
Well, and there are dangers, just like the Lazarus Pit, there are dangers with it. Like you lose a part of yourself when you go in, and you know that's memory, and so you have to create a way to recapture your memory. And so, you know, that seems like a plot device that's going to, you know, rear its head, you know, later in the story, that, you know, they'll have to go there and, you know, maybe they're not prepared with their memory box and, you know, emerge sans memory. And, you know, I clued in really quickly that, you know, they almost forget speech, right? So he's talking like Tarzan of old when he comes out of the waters. There's so much here that I liked. But what the stuff that I disliked kind of overweighed it in a lot of respects. I actually
didn't care for this book. I thought the writing was a bit too stiff. I thought there was too
much. Which is surprising from Steve Orlando.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he knows better than this. I think that an editor would have come, an effective editor would have come in and cut a lot of this stuff. Because the whole bit with the, you know, pirates at the beginning of the book who've been laying in slumber for 300 years. And again, you know, there's not enough placing this book in time. You know, like I said, this book occurs in current times, and yet that first page, there's almost nothing on that first page to give you a sense that this is a current era book.
No.
I found this book really frustrating.
I did too.
But yeah, I mean, there are elements that I liked. It's just not enough of them. So I agree with you, Paul. I did not like this book, but there sure were things here, standout things that I liked.
Yeah. But, you know, on the flip side, I also didn't enjoy Zorro number one.
I thought Zorro number one was god awful.
It was so bad. And, you know, and here's the thing. So it's written by Howard Chaykin, who I don't know why, but every few pages, I guarantee this struck you, Aaron. Like, why is it that every five pages someone had to say, "We all know God doesn't exist"?
Yeah.
I was like every character in the book says it at some point. Like, if God existed, oh, I don't believe in God. Like, oh, God, you know, none of us believe in God. God doesn't exist. Like, literally, it's very explicitly said like four or five times in this book. I'm like, what? Why? What is happening? Like, I don't, like, it just struck me. You know, when it's said once, it's like, okay, like it wouldn't have hit me, but it was said so many times in this book, it felt almost like, Howard, are you just trying to tell us you're an atheist? Like, what is happening in this book? You know, I really did not care for the writing on this book. The art by Jorge Fornes is beautiful. You know, very classic. You know, it works. You know, for a Zorro story, it's just part of the wrong book, and part of the salt in the wound of this book is that, you know, we just read an excellent Zorro book, a self-published Zorro book from Sean Gordon Murphy, right, earlier this year in Zorro Man of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, you know, it was basically Zorro by way of Robert Rodriguez. And I loved that book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think one of the things that book embraced that none of these books seem to embrace is adventure and fun. Because there is not a note of humor in Tarzan or Zorro. And I didn't enjoy either one, frankly.
And, you know, I'm not the biggest Howard Chaykin fan in the world. And I know a lot of people are. I'm not one of them. I always find his artwork to be so stylized such that I don't enjoy it. I like his earlier stuff better than I like his current stuff. But I got to tell you, I love the artwork by Jorge Fornes. I thought it was such a wasted opportunity because, you know, the artwork was fantastic throughout the book. It really had that pulpy tone. I loved how the characters were illustrated. I just hated this story. And I hated this. Everybody's a villain. There are multiple factions that are working against Zorro, but I have no sense of the setting because we jump all over the place. So instead of it being set in Mexico or Spain or wherever, it feels like it's a world stage.
Yeah, it jumps all over the place, but in a weird way. Like,
yeah.
You know, like, I think time is intended to be passing between the different scenes, but, like, it doesn't... It kind of feels like people just kind of hop from one place to another very quickly.
Yeah.
And it just... And, you know, given the time frame in which this is set, this is not... Unlike Tarzan, this is not set in modern day.
Right.
We don't get a sense of what year it's set in, but it is certainly, you know, sometime in the past. And so... Yeah.
Somewhere in the 19th century, I believe. But,
yeah,
there are things that just don't make any sense to me. And like we were talking about with Tarzan, it feels like there's a series we haven't read, right? You know, that there were books that happened in front of this. And don't get me wrong, I'm all for starting in media res. But the way this goes, Zorro's out there, and Zorro's an established vigilante, you know, been working in this area for a long time. Everybody knows him. Everybody knows him such that, you know, he's sitting in a bar with a bunch of other guys wearing masks like Zorro. And it's like, you know, are we all cosplaying Zorro in this city? I don't understand what's going on. It was just a really, really weird sort of book. I did not care for it at all. I mean, while I could pick out a number of items that I enjoyed about the Tarzan book, the only thing that I found here that I liked is I just really enjoyed the artwork. Not just the illustration, not just the pencil and ink work, but also the colors. I thought this book looks marvelous. Was not written marvelously.
Yeah, that's sad. Agreed. I was looking forward to both of these books, and I will not purchase the second issue of either one of them.
Yeah. The preview for Zorro's Legacy, which is a modern setting book, it was in the back, had a preview in the back of it.
Aaron Lopresti.
Written by Dan Abnett, you know, a friend of the podcast, Dan Abnett. I'm going to check that out. I'm not going to let this book put me off because I sure do enjoy me some Mr. Abnett.
Yeah, I do wish that the Sean Gordon Murphy thing had taken off a little bit more, had been embraced a bit more, because I liked the storyline that was setting up. That Zorro book. And maybe he'll revisit it, because I think Zorro is in the public domain, and that's why he was able to do that. I didn't enjoy this one. I will check out Zorro Legacy. But speaking of Dan Abnett.
Yes, sir.
We have the new... You know, the new Flash Gordon books, starting with issue zero, we have a brand new creative team on the Flash Gordon book, written by Dan Abnett, art by, I think it's Manuel Garcia. And so, you know, this is 5 years after the events of the prior Flash Gordon storyline. You know, Flash has been grounded. There is a new, it's called the ERA, but I don't remember what it stands for. But there's basically a new government agency.
Earth Rocket.
Rocketry Association, something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Terrible name for an organization.
Yeah, Earth Rocketry Administration.
Yeah, I kept reading it as the Equal Rights Amendment, you know.
Yeah. the Earth Rocketry Administration has, you know, basically set up controls around space travel, and, you know, it's basically, you know, like the Space Force kind of thing. And so, you know, but Flash has been grounded. You know, Flash is too reckless. Even though he has saved the world, he is, you know, he's been grounded. They've taken away his ability for interstellar travel, and he, you know, instead he should be, he's been grounded for education and mentorship of the new recruits. And so, Aaron, you know, we're 3 issues in to this current arc of Flash Gordon. You know, I never actually finished the first one, and
no, I didn't
care for it. I think I got a little mad caved out because they released all these books at the same time of not necessarily great quality. And so I kind of paused for a little bit, but I checked this out, but I'm curious your thoughts on Flash Gordon by Dan Abnett.
Well, I'll reiterate my original issue that I started with, which is, you know, it was not Guided View friendly, which,
correct.
you know, set a tone with me and how I read the book. I will say that the artwork is gorgeous and wholly appropriate to a character such as Flash Gordon. I started with issue zero and then read issues 16 and 17, the three Dan Abnett stories that are out at the moment. I will be really frank about issue zero. I thought issue zero, you know, which was setting the stage for where we are, in terms of how it fits with the other two books, I thought it was garbage.
Yeah.
And I cannot say that enough. And it's not because the book is poorly written. It's not because it's poorly drawn. It's not that it's not setting up something interesting. It's just that in the most key element that it's setting up is completely erased in issues 16 and 17.
Yeah.
So why the fuck was it in issue zero? Issue zero establishes Flash Gordon as a retired hero. You know, he is Time's Man of the Year. He's on the cover of Time. He, you know, is getting his photo shoot and just kind of talking about what's going on, which I thought was a great sort of setup. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it cuts to, you know, so what are you going to do now that you're a retired space adventurer? Well, I'm going to teach. And so he's teaching at the academy to, you know, generate the next generation of space adventurers, you know, the next Flash Gordon, right? And of course, nobody respects him, which I had a problem with. You know, I felt like it should have been more like Top Gun, you know, that, yeah, you know, it should be, wow, these guys are, you know, who was that guy? Well, you know, that guy's call sign, you know. Instead, all these guys are just sort of idiots. And I mean, you, there is literally nothing to admire about any of these guys who are, quote, at the top of their class. But that's fine. Dale Arden shows up, and there is this huge rift that has developed between Dale and Flash. And so I'm like, okay, well, what happened there? Well, all of that's gone when you get to 16 and 17. 16 and 17, Dale and Flash are more or less back on the same page. And I'm like, okay, so why did we include that in issue zero? You know, why was there this? I really found that frustrating.
I always find it frustrating when, so this basically reads like Flash Gordon 2, right? Like, mm-hmm. like it's a sequel to a movie 5 years later. And it does the right thing that I hate in sequels, is that you basically spend the first half of the movie getting the band back together because they've broken up. And I'm like, why do we have to do this?
Exactly.
You know, like they're just going to end up together anyway. So like, what's the point in establishing the rift between them? Because ultimately it won't really come into play once the adventure starts.
Yeah.
Right. And it doesn't. Like they all team up together pretty quickly. And, you know,
I did appreciate the homage to the movie in issue 16 where Zarkov kidnaps them. You know,
yeah, I did appreciate like that.
I'm like, okay, yeah, I see what you're doing there. Mm-hmm. you know. But what I really dislike is how none of the recruits respect Flash. And I can understand how one or two might feel that way. You know, he's an old man, his time's up, he's a relic. You know, I think that, you know, particularly as recent as the events were where, you know, Flash Gordon literally saves the world, it seems like maybe there would be a little bit more respect there, you know?
You would think
but
so.
But what has he done for them recently, Aaron? What has he done for them recently?
Yeah. Yeah, what have you done for me lately? Yeah, a little Janet Jackson there for you. I was frustrated by that. But once the menace gets going in issue 17, I was there for it. I really enjoyed issue 17. I thought issue zero was a slog and scored a big zero with me. Issue 16 was a better read but still troublesome for me. I really enjoyed issue 17. And I thought, and issue 17, I'm like, okay, I'll pick up issue 18.
Okay. I have not finished issue 17. I just started it, but I will check it out. Because, if it hadn't been for this podcast, I probably would have hopped out after zero.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, because we were going to talk about it.
Well, and same with issue 16. If issue 16 is where I had hopped in, You know, if that was my, you know, if there hadn't been an issue zero and an issue 17 in my file and us talking about it today, I would not have ventured beyond issue 16. But I thought issue 17 really had a good feel to it. I enjoyed the action. I enjoyed, you know, Flash getting out there and doing his thing. I think some of the adversarial elements are just a little bit of low-hanging fruit. I want Dan Abnett to reach further for better story and better conflicts. But I did. I enjoyed this. I'm interested to see where it's going.
Yeah, me too.
But, you know, I do have to say I am so less interested in Flash on Earth. I like Flash on Mongo.
Great.
You know, I want Flash, you know, flying with the Hawkman. I want him, you know, out there with the Arborians. I want him out there in the world of Mongo. I like Flash fighting Ming. And, you know, if we've truly eliminated the threat of Ming, I think Dan Abnett's really got his hands full creating a challenging, worthy villain for Flash to go up against.
The son of Ming?
I think some characters are hard to establish as ongoing series.
I agree. And, you know, I think the comic strip does a really good job of that. And they do put a comic strip page in the back of each of these books.
Yeah.
I wish they would collect the comic strip and release them as floppy comics. Because I think the comic strip is just superior. I love the art. Nice, fun storytelling. Yeah, it's great. It's a win. I hate reading it day to day, week to week. I want to read it as a collected monthly. And I wish they'd give that guy a monthly book. You know, I can't remember the artist's name, but I do really enjoy the current Flash Gordon comic strip is a huge win. It's a great book.
All right.
So, hey, Paul.
Yes, sir.
What's coming out next week?
Well, big Superman week. We have the newest issues of Superman, issue 39, Absolute Superman, issue 20, and Superman Father of Tomorrow, issue 2. From Marvel Comics, we have... Oh, wait, actually, before I hop over to Marvel Comics, also from DC Comics, the Summer of Supergirl special is a new, you know, Supergirl-focused book with creative teams, writers including Mark Wade and Gail Simone.
Isn't the movie out next week?
Yes.
I believe the movie is coming out, yeah.
I was going to ask who's planning to watch it before Saturday.
I will be seeing it next week. We may have to delay recording because I'll probably see it on Saturday.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll talk. Yeah, we will definitely catch that one. Summer of Supergirl special. From Marvel Comics, we have the Ultimate Universe finale. I don't know how many finales we need, but apparently the current iteration of the Ultimate Universe has one more book in it, which is the Ultimate Universe finale. And from Image Comics and Skybound, there's actually a book I'm quite interested in checking out, Universal Monsters, Blood of the Wolfman. And so, you know, Skybound has made this partnership with Universal Studios and the classic Universal Monsters. They've been doing a couple of series. I enjoyed the Creature from the Black Lagoon one. They've done a Dracula one. They've done a Frankenstein one.
I like the Dracula one. Blood of
the Wolfman. Yeah, the Dracula one I haven't read, but I do want to check it out. But this Blood of the Wolfman one is actually written by Joshua Williamson from G.I. Joe and Superman. I'm curious about this one. So I will be checking out Blood of the Wolfman issue 1 next week.
Very good. Well, hey, we want to know what you thought about this week's books. What you thought about Tarzan, Zorro, and Flash Gordon. Give us a shout at ideologyofmadness@gmail.com. And if we use your comments on the show, you could win a coveted, valuable Ideology of Madness surprise.
You can also hit us up on social media, IOMGeek on Facebook, Instagram, and X.
Well, what a deal, guys. I'm gonna run out there and chase the ball and kick the ball. And score with the ball. That's what.
Just don't touch the ball with your hand. No. Yeah, and football is also death. That's the ball's
life. Very good. All right. See you next week, guys.
Catch you then. Bye.
Podcast theme music graciously provided by Mark Andrew Pope. For more information, visit markandrewpope.com. Funny Books with Aaron and Polly is a production of ideologyofmadness.com. No Spider-Man clones were harmed in the production of this podcast.